yourself, little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan, 'cause everyone's lost chin deep in the sand. And what they're trying to sell to you, you shouldn't be buying. Think for yourself, little girl. Don't let them tell you how to run your world, 'cause everyone's the same. Choking back that nervous hurl. And if they tell you they ain't, well, they're just lying. Yeah, they're just lying.
Welcome to Thinking Clearly, a show about critical thinking and related topics. I'm Bob Frelick, and I got to tell you right off the bat that co-host Julia Minton is not able to be with us tonight, but she will be back. And we're trying to, in fact, we are building a critical thinking community of listeners to add value to the program. I want to tell you that we want to be as interactive as possible, and so you can contact us. We encourage you to do that. We have a Facebook page. You go to Facebook, just go to the search bar and type in Thinking Clearly Radio, and our Facebook page will pop up. You can ask questions, give comments, and that kind of thing, or you can email us. And the email address for this show is tc@kmud.org. We're working pretty hard on a three-part working definition of critical thinking that we've taken bits and pieces from other definitions of critical thinking, thought about the issue, and trying to make as comprehensive a description of what critical thinking is that as we can. And I've talked about that definition before, but I'm just going to read the part tonight that relates to tonight's topic. It goes like this, quote, critical thinking also includes an awareness of and attempt to compensate for the vulnerabilities that we have in our thought process, including cognitive biases such as confirmation bias. To heighten our awareness of the human thought processes, we, of course, have to turn to the field of cognitive science. There are other fields, of course, that we can garner information from, but tonight's topic is going to focus on findings from cognitive science. Specifically, we're going to find that we all suffer from thinking that we know more than we really do, whereas the real wealth of human knowledge resides in our communities. That is, when we're compelled to explain how something works, not just how we use something, but how it works, including political issues and policies, then we're forced to confront our lack of knowledge. And that idea and its implications and related studies from cognitive science is going to kick off our discussion with guest Professor Stephen Sloman, one of the authors of a recent book called The Knowledge Illusion, Why We Never Think Alone. Let me give a little introduction to Dr. Stephen Sloman. He's a professor of cognitive, linguistic, and psychological sciences at Brown University, and he's the editor-in-chief of the journal Cognition. In addition to researching human inductive inference, judgments of probability, and decision-making, Professor Sloman has focused on how people reason causally about the world, prompting his previous book, the book he wrote previous to the one we're going to talk about tonight. And that previous book was called How We Think About the World and Its Alternatives. So we're going to have Dr. Sloman on with us shortly. I have a copy of the book here. The co-author is a colleague of Stephen Sloman's, I think a previous graduate student in the Sloman lab, and his name is Philip Fernbach. So it's a good read. We're going to talk about some of the information in that book. We're not going to be able to cover everything in the book, but we're going to talk about some of the information in the book. Welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Thanks. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. I can hear you in one ear. I don't know. I'm only getting you in one ear. I'm not sure what's going on with that, but I'll take it.
All right. Hopefully it's the right ear and not the wrong ear.
It is the right ear, actually. But I'm left-eared. I don't know. Let's start out to bring listeners up to speed on the main ideas that are presented in your new book. Let's take a quick run through some of the main points that you and co-author Philip Fernbach make in The Knowledge Illusion, starting with how much us human beings typically know about things, how things work in the world around us, and how that compares with our ratings of how much we really know.
Well, it turns out that people are remarkably ignorant. There's all sorts of reason to believe that we just don't know very much. 25% of Americans don't know whether the Earth revolves around the sun or the sun revolves around the Earth. And, 60% of Americans can't name all three branches of government. I mean, there's all kinds of reason to think that we're relatively ignorant. But the real point of the book isn't that people are stupid. The real point is that we think we know more than in fact we do. And so this was first demonstrated in a very clever experiment by a great psychologist at Yale named Frank Kyle and his students. And what they did was they asked people to rate how well they understood how various everyday objects work, like ballpoint pens and zippers and toilets. And people gave ratings, generally in the middle of the scale. They felt they had a sense of how these everyday objects work. And then the psychologist said to them, "How do they work? Please explain in as much detail as you can." And what they found was that people were pretty much unable to explain how they worked. They knew remarkably little. So when they asked the participants again how well they understood, their ratings were lower. It was as if asking them to explain punctured their illusion of understanding, and they had to admit that they didn't understand so well.
And you're a teacher. I suspect I've been a teacher in the past, and I suspect that almost every teacher knows that exactly, right? Knows that, thinks about, I have to explain this to the class. How well do I really know it? And sometimes as we're gaining experience as teachers, we come in touch with just exactly how little we knew about what we thought we knew a lot about when we try to explain it.
That's a terrific example. That's right. I feel like the only way to really understand something is to teach it. And then you figure it out. You figure it out because you discover the holes in your explanation. So it's really important when you're teaching something new to first go through it carefully by yourself. Teach it to yourself so that you can teach it to your students. Otherwise, they'll get wise and point out all of your flaws and shortcomings.
Exactly. And I will share with you some of the thoughts as I was reading through your book that come up. One of the thoughts that I got kind of right off the bat with this is that when you began to talk about the complexity in the world and the complexity of these things that we think are simple, is that there certainly is downsides to that, but there's also, in my mind, sort of an upside to that, being that we can treat some things as a black box. In other words, an architect who's drawing the plans for some building or something does not have to know exactly how a sink works or a toilet works, a ventilation system, something like that, to draw it into the plans. He can almost treat it, or she can almost treat it, as a black box. So it gives a chance to sort of go to another level of thinking to some extent. So what's your opinion on that?
Yeah, no, I think that that's exactly right. We don't have to know the details of things, and we get by just fine without knowing those details. So to fully answer your question, I guess I have to go into the other main point of the book, which is an attempt to explain why it is that we have this illusion that we understand. And our idea is that we have this illusion because we live in a community of knowledge. So we may not understand how toilets work, but there's someone else who does, namely the plumber. And we have access to that knowledge. And we confuse what the expert, in this case the plumber, knows with what we know. And the reason we confuse them is that generally we live in this community, we rely on other people's knowledge all the time, and it's not really important whether the knowledge is sitting in our head or in somebody else's head or somewhere else, because knowledge is all around us. Knowledge is everywhere. And so I think what you're saying really draws from the fact that all we really need to know is where to access the information. And that's the sense in which we just need a placeholder in the head. We need a little pointer to where the information is, as opposed to having the information itself.
And that's an idea that I want to talk about some more as we progress. But I'd like you to explain a little bit, because a lot of folks are not really aware of how cognitive scientists actually verify their hypotheses. So that's quite a hypothesis, that the majority of our knowledge and our feeling that we know much about something resides in a community of knowledge outside of us, outside of our head. How did you actually verify that as a hypothesis?
Well, that's a great question. So cognitive scientists build theories and build models of those theories, but we also run experiments and collect data in order to test the theories. And so in this case, there was a lot of data lying around that seemed best explained by this idea that we live in a community of knowledge. So for instance, there's a psychologist named Dan Wagner who had done a lot of work showing that people remember things according to their expertise. So, for instance, if you take a couple, a husband and wife or any kind of couple, say one of them is a wine expert and the other one is an expert in something else, accounting. If somebody comes along and says, oh, I just saw these great wines on sale at the local wine store, and starts listing the wines, the accountant isn't even gonna listen generally. Certainly not gonna bother trying to remember the wines, because they don't mean very much to him or her. Instead, what'll happen is they'll let the expert remember the information that's relevant to their expertise. They'll remember the wines that the couple is being told about. And if someone else comes along and starts talking about how to save taxes, well, that's in the accountant's area of expertise. And so that's something the accountant will retain and be able to make use of. So in general, there's a lot of evidence that not only do we retain information that's relevant to our expertise, but we expect other people to retain information only if it's relevant to their expertise, which is a very natural thing, right? I mean, if let's say you're building a house and you have a plumber, an electrician, and a painter, and a carpenter, and you're wondering who remembered to bring the pipes to build the toilet, well, you're going to expect that to be the plumber. And if it's something about, you know, the woodwork necessary to build cabinets in the kitchen, you're going to expect that to be the carpenter. So we generally ask people to do things within their areas of specialty. And what's interesting is just how narrow our areas of specialty are. So that's one kind of evidence that suggests that we live and think and remember in a community of knowledge. Should I tell you about another kind of experiment that I've done in my lab?
Definitely.
Makes the same point. So with the student at Brown, Nat Reb, what we did was to one group of people, we said, scientists have discovered this scientific phenomenon, and we had actually made up the phenomenon. It was something like helium rain. We said these scientists discovered a system of helium rain. They haven't explained it yet. They don't understand it, but they've discovered it. They see that it exists. How well do you understand it? Our subject said, well, I don't understand it at all. I mean, even the scientists don't understand it. You just told me about it. Of course I don't understand it. Another group of people, we said the same thing. We said scientists have discovered this system called helium rain. They understand it. Okay, they have fully explained it. We didn't tell them anything about what the explanation was. We merely said that the scientists had explained it, that they understood it. And now we said, how well do you understand it? And now people had a slightly greater sense of understanding. They ticked off a higher number on the rating scale we gave. So it's not as if they fully understood helium rain, but instead of giving one on a 1 to 7 scale, they now gave 2 on a 1 to 7 scale, as if they just had this tiny sense of understanding merely from the fact that other people understand. So we call this contagious understanding, right? When you're around people who understand, you feel like you understand. And we've actually demonstrated this now in Spain and in India. And we've shown it not just with scientific phenomena, but also with political policies. So we made up these political policies and we said that researchers either understood the implications of the policies or they don't yet understand the implications of the policies. And when researchers understand, then our subjects felt that they understood better than when the researchers don't understand.
So that it's not just a phenomenon that's found in one culture, for example.
That's correct.
You're saying there's some cross-cultural.
It's not found with just one type of thing. It seems to be a very general thing. If other people understand, then that mere fact gives you a sense of understanding. It's kind of like back to your teacher example, right? You were talking about how teachers discover they don't understand when they try to teach. Well, another thing that happens in the classroom is that students sitting there listening to a teacher who clearly understands what they're talking about makes the student feel like they understand even when they don't. So another phenomenon you find in the education literature is something called the illusion of comprehension, right? Where students have this illusion that they understand everything that's going on, even when they have no idea. And this is a particular problem when students are reading stuff, right? Yeah. You give them a text to read, and the information is all in the text. So as the students are passing their eyes over the text, reading a novel or a scientific textbook, they feel like they understand while they're reading it, even though they're not seriously taking it in. So that when you then give them a test to see how well they do comprehend, they are shocked to discover that they don't comprehend at all. They do really poorly on the test. And sometimes they're really surprised that they did poorly because they thought they understood.
Sure. That's the dreaded, rather than multiple choice, the short answer or essay question.
Right.
Getting back to, I did want to say one of the things that it made me think of is just anecdotally from experience. Anybody who's been married for more than a year knows how much we begin to compartmentalize those things that we know about, those jobs that we do, those skills that we acquire. My wife and I have been married for 47 years, and we are getting to that point now where we're asking each other questions and saying, well, you got to write down how to do this and this and this, and because we have an awareness that we've compartmentalized so much knowledge in our marriage. But I want to get back to just one detail here, and it's back to the idea of appraising how much we really know, because in your book you mentioned the Dunning-Kruger effect. Can you explain that to our listeners?
Sure. The Dunning-Kruger effect is that people who don't do something very well not only don't have the requisite knowledge, but they don't know what it would take to do it well. So, for instance, if you consider someone who's really bad at math, not only do they not know a lot of math, but they don't understand what it would mean to be good at math. They don't understand how sophisticated math can be because they're still struggling with the early stages of math. And this is true of anything, right? It's true of people who are computer technicians. If they're just starting out, then they may not know a whole lot about fixing computers, but neither do they know what it would take to be really good at fixing computers. So what this means is that people who are not very capable tend to overestimate their abilities, right? They overestimate their abilities because they don't appreciate what it would mean to be really good at something. They think that, you know, they may appreciate that they're not great, but they don't understand what the realm of possibility is at what they're doing. Whereas people who are expert, they not only have a lot of knowledge, but they appreciate how much knowledge they could have. They appreciate how complex the domain is and what it would take to really understand. So they don't tend to underestimate their knowledge so much, right? So the people who are overconfident about what they know tend to be the people with less skill, not mm-hmm. the people with more skill. That's the basic idea.
Reminds me of a quote from Bertrand Russell. The quote goes like this: one of the painful things about our time is that those who feel certainly are stupid, and those with any imagination and understanding are filled with doubt and indecision.
That's perfect. Yeah, that's exactly it. The way I like to put it is that it's taken me decades to learn how much I don't know.
Exactly. All right, let's move on a little bit here and talk about another thing that you've studied, and it's talked about in your book too, but I get the impression that your previous book was probably more to this, and that is human beings' abilities at causal reasoning. I always look at that word and want to say causal reasoning, but it's causal reasoning.
Yeah.
But also cite examples of in your book, you cite some examples of faulty causal reasoning. For example, trying to heat up a house faster by turning up the thermostat. Can you just briefly talk about that example?
Sure. Well, let me try to contextualize it a little bit. So the main idea of the book, if you ask what are people good at, what kind of reasoning are people good at, what we claim is that, you know, we're not natural mathematicians, we're not natural logicians. What we do is tell causal stories. That is, we try to figure out how the world works and make predictions, generate explanations, and tell narratives, tell literally stories about how the world works. And the reason we do that is that thought is an extension of action, right? So we are organisms, we evolved, and we evolved by virtue of acting successfully in the world. And so what my co-author and I believe is that the trick, what it is that allowed us to evolve to the extent we did, is the fact that we could support our actions by thinking. And causal thinking is the kind of thinking that's going to support action, because actions are causes. They have effects on the world. If I'm rubbing stones together to create a fire, then I have to understand what the cause, rubbing stones, will do, what its effect will be. I have to have a causal analysis of fire. Or if I'm making a canoe, I have to have a causal analysis of how you make a canoe and what you would do with a canoe and how you could fish with it and that kind of thing. So the first claim is that to the extent we're good at thinking, what we're good at is causal reasoning. But what prompted this book is the observation that even though that's what we're good at, we're actually not as good at it as we think, right? We make a lot of mistakes when we're reasoning causally. And one reason is that we have ineffective causal models. So you mentioned heating our house, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you turn up a thermostat, if your house is too cold and you want to and you have central heating and you want to make it warmer, right? I mean, one thing you could do, I suppose, is build a fire, and we're pretty good at that. But if you want to use your central heating, then you turn up the thermostat. And it turns out that it doesn't matter how high you turn the thermostat. If you want the temperature to be 72, you should put the thermostat at 72, and the temperature will rise till it hits 72. And if you put it at 80, it's not going to rise any faster. But that's what people do. They have the sense that if they, the higher they put it, the faster the house will warm up.
Exactly.
We have bad causal models.
Exactly. And even if you know it, I mean, I know something about bimetallic thermostats and how they work and how heaters work. But I've done that. I've done that very thing. I'm going to heat the house up real fast, turn it way up, and I know better, but I've still done it.
It's very compelling. And that's probably an analogy from other things, right? Like if you want to heat up water, if you want hot water to come out of the tap, then it actually is faster if you open the tap completely.
Well, it kind of reminds me, too, of how important it is, causal knowledge about things, because, the example of pre-Louis Pasteur, before they had germ theory, they didn't know enough to wash their hands and use basic hygiene. I was reading an account of a Hungarian physician, Ignaz Semmelweis was his name, but he worked apparently in a hospital in Vienna, and there was a great amount of childbirth deaths, maternal childbirth deaths. It could be as high as 30% in his hospital. It ranged from 13 to 30%, and he started keeping track of that, and just got the intuition that there was something that doctors and students, because students would be helping in the delivery, were carrying in and causing this epidemic of deaths among women that were giving birth. And so he instituted like a hygiene cleanliness program at his hospital, found that the mortality rate did go down, but people didn't believe it. So they didn't really institute those policies actually until Louis Pasteur operated to change our paradigm and our thinking. It was microbes that were causing it.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know what? That's a great example. And I think one thing it shows is not only how important causal reasoning is, and, causal reasoning is what research is about for the most part. Certainly medical research and most kinds of research, they're about figuring out what causes what. But what that example also shows is just how hard causal reasoning can be, right? Yeah. And in fact, it's taken society millennia, thousands, tens of thousands of years in order to figure out how many things work. So we're just now, learning about, last century we learned about germs, and we're just now figuring out how the genetic system works and, how DNA gets processed, and there are surprises every day. And there are all kinds of things we don't understand, like about how particles work in nuclear physics. And it's taken a lot of time because it's very hard. And the other thing that, thinking about the progress of science reveals is the degree to which it's a social enterprise. No one person is capable of it, right? You need entire communities working on problems, supporting each other in order to accomplish anything.
Well, part of what we're about on this show is to advocate for the utility and usefulness of critical thinking and literacy, science literacy, technology literacy. And it makes me think that part of what I'd like to do in future shows, we've done a little bit of this, is to actually have someone come on who is a professor of biology, someone who's a professor of physics, that sort of thing, who can give not all the details, but the basic causal model for some of the things that relate to those everyday things that we need to make decisions on, like vaccination, the immune system, GMO, the fundamentals of how genetics works. A big one is there are people that are fearful of microwaves and radio waves and that sort of thing. With the idea coming on as a physicist talking about the difference between high energy ionizing kinds of radiation as opposed to low energy, the longer wavelengths, which are non-ionizing and don't penetrate the body and are unable to knock electrons out of those our DNA and our proteins. So I'm hoping that by giving some of these fundamentals that relate to issues that folks need to at least have a basic understanding of can help that along.
Well, I think that's a fantastic idea. Because it'll help separate out information from the misinformation that's all around us these days, right? The trick in making good decisions is to suss out the true expertise in the community and follow the advice of the experts.
Mm-hmm.
And having radio shows like yours bring the experts on in order to convince people that one way of thinking about things is more effective than another seems to me the best way to do that.
We've talked about on this show before the fast or system one thinking versus the slow or system two thinking. And I think in your book, you prefer the terms intuitive versus deliberative
yes.
modes of thinking.
Yeah.
And you talk about the cognitive reflection test and being cognitively reflective. I think that's a very critical issue. Can you discuss that? Just kind of encapsulate that issue a little bit.
Sure, absolutely. So intuitive thinking is essentially a kind of pattern recognition, right? What people are really good at is recognizing patterns. Every time you look around you and you see a scene and you see the objects in that scene and identify, you know, what's a car and what's a tree and what's a house and what's a human being, etc., you're essentially recognizing patterns. And people are amazingly good at that. In fact, many animals are amazingly good at that. And I think of that as an intuitive process, and that's what the brain does. Right? That's the kind of thinking that goes on inside the skull. Deliberation, on the other hand, is a kind of thinking that it's more sequential. It's a kind of thinking you're aware of. So if I say to you, what's 2 + 3, then you just intuitively know the answer is 5. That goes on inside your head. But if I say, what's 89 plus 124, well, now you may be able to answer the question, but you're going to have to think. You're going to have to deliberate a little. You might actually pull out a piece of paper and use the world to help you solve the problem. Or you can use another person and you can talk it through. So it's a different kind of thinking, right? It's one in which we're not just conscious of the result of the process, as we are with intuition. We're also conscious of the steps that take us to the result. And I like the word deliberation because it has two senses. One is just sort of reflective thought, right? Thinking about things in a careful, sequential way. But another sense of deliberation is a group activity, like juries deliberate in order to make decisions. And I love that ambiguity because it's exactly the ambiguity that I see in deliberative cognition, in deliberative processes of thought, right? They are sequential, we are aware of them, but for the most part, they actually go on between people. Or between a person and the world, right? Like sometimes we deliberate with a blackboard or with a piece of paper, and sometimes we deliberate with other people. So it's a very different kind of thinking, and it's really the kind of thinking that the book is focused on. It's the kind of thinking that matters for scientific discovery. It's the kind of thinking that matters when you're engaged in any kind of novel thought. It's also the kind of thinking that matters when people are making decisions together, like political decisions, right? Or if you're trying to persuade someone of something else, of something, then you're going to be deliberating with that person.
And we know that there are times where that fast thinking, that intuitive thinking is appropriate, and other times when the more deliberative approach is what is going to give us the best answer and the best process. But how do we actually acquire the ability to know the difference between those, when it's appropriate to be intuitive, when it's appropriate to be deliberative, and to acquire skills in both of those? How do we do that? I mean, that's the hard part, because a lot of people will come up, especially in the political realm, and they'll get their first hit on it, and that's it. They don't change. They don't think about it. They don't want to look at other evidence. So, they go by the intuitions. They go by their whatever their built-in worldview that they have is. So how do we actually make progress in that?
Yeah, well, that's the million-dollar question. And I think the best way to think about that is in terms of the experiment that we started this conversation with, what we call the illusion of explanatory depth, where you ask people to how well they understand, and then you ask them to explain, and then again you ask them how well they understand. And the act of explanation tends to make people more humble, because when they can't explain, notice that explaining something is a deliberative act, right? So generating a rating of your own understanding, well, intuition can do that. Like, I intuit that I understand how ballpoint pens work. But now if you ask me to explain it, what you're doing is you're asking me to deliberate about it. And now I discover how weak my intuitions are, because they're not helping me to deliberate about it. So with one experiment that I was involved with was one where we showed the illusion of explanatory depth with political issues. So we took, say, whether or not there should be unilateral sanctions on Iran. And we asked people how well they understood the implications of such a policy. And, you know, people tended to think they understood it pretty well. And then we said, okay, explain. What would be the consequences of this policy? And people were, for the most part, unable to. They just didn't really know what the specific consequences were. So, again, when we asked them how well they understood now, their ratings went down, they were more humble. But what's interesting is they also became less extreme. They became less polarized as a group on the issue, because they realized that they didn't really understand, right? That they didn't have the knowledge to support a really strong political position. Earlier you mentioned the CRT, the cognitive reflection test. So what that is a measure of the degree to which people just respond intuitively or whether they think before they speak. So I'll give you an example of a problem on that test. Okay, everybody has to get their thinking hats on for a second. A bat and a ball cost $1.10 together. The bat costs a dollar more than the ball. How much does the ball cost? So I'll repeat it quickly. Yeah. The bat and the ball cost $1.10. The bat costs a dollar more than the ball. How much does the ball cost? Now, most people at this point think, well, the ball costs 10 cents. But if the ball costs 10 cents and the bat costs a dollar more than the ball, then the bat costs $1.10, and together they cost $1.20. So the answer is not 10 cents, right? Because I told you that together they only cost $1.10. So I'll let you and your listeners think about what the right answer is. It's not hard, but it's not 10 cents. So the point of the problem is that 10 cents comes to almost everybody's mind. Most people, about 70% of the population, just say 10 cents. That's their answer. And many people are adamant that they're correct, actually.
Yes.
Another 30% of the population do the little bit of arithmetic necessary, realize that 10 cents is not the answer, and so they go back and do some more calculations and figure out the right answer.
Yeah. And another segment says, this is too easy. This must be a trick question. And then
there are certainly some people, like, yes, I have some colleagues like that.
Yeah.
But of course, they're generally the ones who got it wrong in the first
place. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I'm familiar with those. There's three questions in that. And the hope is, and I know you've talked about this in another interview that I listened to, is that we can actually train people to be more cognitive.
Well, yeah. So actually, can I comment on that?
Sure.
So the first thing I want to say is, it turns out that people who do very well on the cognitive reflection test, people who are reflective in the sense of thinking before they speak, they do not suffer from the illusion of explanatory depth.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. If you just test those people, you'll discover that they are able to rate their understanding even before they explain. They're able to rate their understanding correctly even before you ask them to explain how something works. It's really the non-reflective people who have this illusion of understanding. So on the question of whether you can train people to be reflective, I'm actually a little pessimistic about that. I'm not sure you can. I think you can train people within a particular area of expertise. Like, I think doctors probably don't suffer from the illusion too much when they're talking about medicine. And, you know, radio talk show hosts don't suffer from the illusion too much when they're talking about being a radio talk show host, because those are domains in which you have expertise. And you appreciate not only what you do know, but also what you don't know. It's very hard to get people to be reflective in general. It's an intuitive process. So you can ask people to, and on certain occasions you might succeed. But I really think the best way to get people to be reflective is to make it a norm of the culture.
Yes, definitely.
You can't build it into an individual head. You have to build it into society.
Right. And I agree completely with that. I think you can. I'm a little more optimistic than you. I think we can build it into our early education. In fact, I think that the Common Core, which stresses collaboration, creativity, communication, and critical thinking, is beginning to do that. And I think that's the goal. We do have a caller. And so let's go ahead and take some calls. So we'll take the first call. Welcome to
Hi.
Thinking Clearly.
Yes, I don't want to put things out of order too much, but this goes back to Dr. Semmelweis and pattern recognition, which I think there is a connection that was not made there. Went through it pretty fast. I read an article in the New York Review book some years ago about Semmelweis and this discovery of his or recognition of his, and I think that it's important to recognize what it was. Semmelweis was a lower grade doctor. He wasn't. You're not supposed to argue with your superiors who've been in the business longer, but he was working in this hospital and noticed that there was an absurdly high rate of childbirth mortality there, and scratching his head. They didn't know much about germs in those days, but he just scratched. So what's different about the hospital from home births, which were much more successful in this respect? And snooping around, he discovered that the pattern of duties in the hospital was that the young doctors would come in the morning, go down to the morgue in the bottom and disassemble corpses for the morning, learning about how people are built. And then they'd come out without washing their hands, because, of course, doctors never washed their hands in those days, and help with a childbirth. And he didn't, I don't believe that he knew what was wrong with this, but he recognized it as a pattern that's quite different from doctors assisting childbirth at home or childbirth at home without any doctors. And he complained about it, and he was not well regarded for that. He was really annoyed that he was telling his superiors what to do, but they tried it, and it worked. Well, he was using pattern recognition, and I think that's very significant.
Yeah, the advantage of actually accurately recognizing patterns even before there's a theory to go along
That's what I'm getting at. He wasn't looking for some way to tie germs in with this because they didn't know what germs were about. He was really using pattern recognition to see, well, what's going on that could be done differently and see if that would result in different results, which it certainly did.
Well, great. Thank you. Thank you much for the backstory on that. Do you have any questions for Dr. Sloman?
Well, no, I've forgotten the thing you were talking about just when I came on, and there was something that that I would have liked to add to, but let me clear the line for you. Must have somebody else by now waiting.
Well, if it dawns on you, give a call back.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for that information.
All right. While we're waiting to see if there are some other callers, let's go on with some other thoughts here. You talked about the community of knowledge, and that's a big part of your book. And the promise that it offers, for example, on page 151, you say, quote, "The web is demonstrating the real superintelligence resides in the community." Mm. When I read that, I thought about, but how do we really distill the real knowledge away from all the misinformation and disinformation that's on the internet? Because the internet is one of the largest sources of this community of knowledge that we go to. It's very accessible, but it also has a lot of misinformation, disinformation on it. How do we distill that away? How do we utilize that in an effective way?
Yeah. Well, that's a tough problem, and I know that there are a lot of people at Facebook and Google and all over the technological world who are struggling to solve that problem. I think that the way to think about it is in terms of where the knowledge resides, right? So if you think about knowledge as something that exists within a community rather than just something we have direct access to, then what that reveals is that in order to know, what we really need is to be able to pick out the right set of experts, and we have to trust them. So as individuals, when we're trying to become educated, then we're faced with that problem of identifying true expertise and trying to learn from the source of that expertise. And as recipients of information on the web, we were faced with exactly that problem. Right? How do we separate the wheat from the chaff? How do we recognize true expertise? And, you know, the way to do it isn't really a big secret, I don't think. We've been doing it as a society since time immemorial. So we have institutions that accredit people. And presumably, you know, if somebody has a doctorate from Harvard, there's something that they know, that they've learned in order to obtain that credential. It doesn't make them an expert on everything, but presumably they know something about the subject matter that they got the doctorate in. And if somebody is an engineer from the University of Louisiana, well, they have a credential from an accredited institution, and you know, and that should be worth something. So we need to have a criminal justice system which makes sure that accredited institutions really deserve that accreditation. So we have to have trust in, you know, all the systems that together decide who are going to be authorities and who aren't.
And get them on speed dial. get them on speed dial and bookmark them on our computers.
That's right. Or, you know, well, I mean, these days we go to the right websites. We have our websites of choice that we believe, right?
And fact-checking
websites, too. Like, if you're listening to someone who's a true expert, often what you'll find is they are not overly confident, right? Because they appreciate how complex things are and how much they don't know, they're actually often less sure of themselves, less certain than the people who don't know anything, who are just pushing a line.
Okay, we have a couple callers on the line here, so we'll take next caller.
Welcome
to Thinking Clearly.
Hi.
Yes, I think I have a few more details on the Semmelweis story, because I remember studying about that in physiology class. And I don't have every single detail, but what I do know is that what Semmelweis noticed was that in the hospitals where they were delivering the babies, the doctors would go from doing operations, I believe autopsies, and dealing with cadavers, and would go right into, you know, the delivery room to help with delivering the babies. And these women would get what they called childbed fever. They would come down with these horrible infections and die, you know, from high fevers and infections. And there was no antibiotics, and they didn't understand about germs. But just noticing that, he felt like, you know, it was a dirty situation. Something there was, he just kind of instinctively felt that there should be more cleanliness going on if you're going to go from doing an autopsy on a cadaver to going to deliver a baby. And he started having them wash their hands with soap and water before going in to deliver the baby if they had been working on these autopsies. And sure enough, when they washed their hands and cleaned up and, you know, maybe even changed their you know, thing they were wearing or whatever, the women didn't get sick. And it was like a clear, you know, well, okay, maybe he didn't understand all the logistics of why, but he could see there was a clear connection there.
Yeah.
So he started to promote this and to tell, you know, doctors, wash your hands and clean up before you come into the delivery room. Well, when his superiors found out about that, they didn't like that he was telling people what to do, and he didn't have that authority. And you know, people's egos, they hadn't thought of that. And even though the evidence was clear that this was saving lives, they didn't like it. And in their arrogance, they actually fired him. They persecuted him. They fired him. They wouldn't allow him anymore, you know, to work in the hospital. And he was so he had a nervous breakdown and ended up dying in a mental institution.
Yeah. Well, thank you. That reinforces the idea that you can use both systems. Both systems were in play. There may be a deliberative system to identify the patterns and try to recognize some correlations with other things, plus the intuitive, which brought out the idea that, well, let's try this. Let's try cleaning up our act here, cleaning our hands and washing our hands. I think we have one more caller. Thank you very much, caller. We'll take that last caller. Welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Hi, you had a caller several minutes ago who brought up the issue of pattern recognition. I'd like to hear your guests talk about the equally important issue of false pattern recognition. For instance, like the man on the moon, people are convinced, oh, they see a face in the moon. Of course, there is no face in the moon. In recent decades, people have convinced themselves they've seen all kinds of things, for instance, from the Mars rover, photos. People, from the 70s, they thought they saw a face on Mars. Of course, in recent years, we've gotten new photos that show that there was no face on Mars. It was just a, you know, trick of light and shadow. But people are convinced, for instance, they see faces and all sorts of things because it's a very primary image. It's what we see when we come into this world as a baby. The first thing we see is a face. It's what we can recognize.
Yes.
As a human being very easily, but we see faces, for instance, in all sorts of places where they don't actually exist. That's a
okay, good question. What's your Dr. Sloman's response?
Yeah, that's a fascinating point, and I think what it shows is that we really are pattern recognition devices, right? So we're constantly looking for patterns, and even when we're just seeing random noise, we tend to find structure where there isn't any. And that's why it's so important to not only have these intuitive pattern recognition processes, because they're not perfect and they find all kinds of structure that doesn't exist. It's also important to be able to check with other people, right, and with our own deliberative processes to see if what we're seeing is real. So science has developed this, you know, the methodology in order to check whether the patterns that scientists are observing are replicable, whether they're real or whether they're not. That's what the field of statistics is all about. So the listener's really observant point is one that demonstrates not only how natural pattern recognition is, but how important it is to go beyond pattern recognition in order to have these communal processes of deliberation that allow us to check on pattern.
Well, thank you very much. We're right almost to the top of the hour, and I want to thank you very much. We've been talking to Dr. Stephen Sloman, Professor of Cognitive, Linguistic, and Psychological Sciences at Brown University and Editor-in-Chief of the journal Cognition, and co-author of the book, The Knowledge Illusion, Why We Never Think Alone. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much, Bob.
And that will do it for this edition of Thinking Clearly. Join us again next month, first Thursday, from 7 to 8 p.m. on KMUD.
Joanna tells you that they have the plan, 'cause everyone's lost. Chin deep in the sand, and what they're trying to sell to you, you shouldn't be buying.
This program was produced in KMUD's Redway Studios and is provided courtesy of KMUD, People Powered Radio.